You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Fairhead. The famous Badger statue outside the governor's state capitol office is staying put for now. We'll find out why the U.S. Navy wants it back coming up. Now, President Biden met on Monday with a group of Republican senators to talk about the potential for compromise on their different plans for another economic relief package. Biden's $1.9 trillion relief plan would include $1,400 checks to many Americans, extra unemployment benefits, and funding for state and local governments. Republicans have put forth a plan worth $618 billion that would cover $1,000 checks and a shorter window of extra unemployment support. As of today, congressional Democrats appear to be moving ahead with a plan on their own. It comes as a new economic team led by Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has endorsed the idea of more relief spending, due in part to low federal interest rates. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think another economic relief package is needed at all? If so, should it be big or really big or somewhere in between? Would another round of direct payments or unemployment benefits help you and your family? Should support for state governments be part of the deal? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Menzie Chin is professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. Menzie, welcome back.
Hello, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Before we dig into details of the plans coming out of Senate Republicans and Democrats in Washington, just looking at the state of the economy now, do we need some kind of further intervention from the federal government? And if so, what would you want to see that look like?
Okay, that's an excellent question. And I think that many people think that, you know, given all the spending that's taken place, you know, several trillion dollars worth up till December of last year, you know, maybe we have things underway so that we don't need more action. And the Congressional Budget Office, which is a nonpartisan scorekeeper for the economy, has just released these projections a couple days ago that indicate that, you know, even with all the stimulus and spending that's in the system, with the Federal Reserve working its best to stimulate the economy, you know, we are looking at an economy that's running at around 3% below what it could be, okay? That is below potential GDP. That works out to being like $420 billion worth of output, less than what we could be producing. Just this year alone, and if I look out over the next few years, 3 years horizon, it's like $800 billion. So I don't think we should be too sanguine about where the economy is going in the absence of further fiscal action.
One concern, of course, is we've spent a lot of money. That's deficit spending. In effect, there have been concerns, you know, for decades now that too much government debt soaks up liquidity. It can be a drag on the economy in the short and maybe especially the long term. How worried are you about another big package boosting the federal debt?
Well, I think it's important to put things in context. I was worried about a big hit to the government's finances back in 2017 when we gave a multi-trillion dollar plus tax cut at a time when the economy arguably didn't need it. Now you have to look at things, the issue about whether to undertake more spending on the part of the government and build up more debt from two angles. First of all, what would the spending accomplish? Would it prevent firms and businesses and individuals from suffering a lot, from going out bankrupt and disappearing and reducing the prospects for the economy going forward? And secondly, if I am borrowing to keep these, you know, these bad outcomes from occurring, what is the interest rate at which I'm borrowing? Well, I can tell you that most recently, the interest rate in real terms, inflation adjusted terms for the U.S. government to borrow for 10 years is about -1%. In fact, in real terms, then, you know, you're paying to lend to the U.S. government. So the costs that we typically worry about from increasing government debt, it's not there for the moment. No guarantees about the future. But the Federal Reserve has pretty much committed itself to keeping at least nominal interest rates low for many years to come, several years to come at a minimum. And presumably that would keep real interest rates very low. So the worries about financing this big budget deficit now, I think should be sort of put on the back burner. You have to weigh the cost of not acting against the cost of incurring more debt, but you're incurring this debt at particularly low interest rates.
And that's the argument that new Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has made. She talked about this during her confirmation hearing last month. Here's a listen.
With interest rates at historic lows, the smartest thing we can do is act big. In the long run, I believe the benefits will far outweigh the costs, especially if we care about helping people who have been struggling for a very long time.
So there's agreeing, Janet Yellen agreeing with the point you just made about interest rates. But let's talk about now how to best help people who are struggling, assuming that there's some kind of federal package. What are the most effective ways to use that money to help people maybe dealing in particular with long-term unemployment?
Well, I think, you know, we're in somewhat uncharted territory because this recession and the recovery has been unlike any previous recession, you know, for 100 years. And even then, you know, going back to the last pandemic, it's not clear what the impact was on the economy. So the standard rules that you might use are might not apply. I will say that, you know, unemployment insurance is probably best typically in the sense that you want to keep those people from suffering in a particularly bad way who have lost their jobs, and you want to keep them engaged in the job market. On the other hand, a lot of people have dropped out of the labor market, not because they were laid off, and in which case you would not necessarily get the unemployment insurance. It's because, for instance, they've had to stay home to take care of the children or to take care of elderly parents who have moved in with them. So ordinarily, I would think that a targeted benefit that goes directly to those who have been unemployed, that would be best. But like I say, the circumstances are quite different in this episode here. And we see that in the sort of divergence in the terms of who has been unemployed. And so you see, for instance, females in the labor market who have been forced to take up a greater share of the burden for whatever reason of childcare and for taking care of parents. They have borne a greater share of the joblessness, not necessarily because they were fired, but because somebody within the household has to take care of those things. In terms of other direction, for instance, one of the things I noticed that is different between the Senate plan and Biden's overall plan is the failure to support state and local governments. There is essentially zero support for state and local governments in the Senate Republicans' plan, as far as we can tell. And what we learned in the last recession, the Great Recession, was that state and localities were hard-pressed to finance all their services in the recovery from the last recession because they can't really borrow that much. And if we were to zero out the support, I think we'd be replicating a recipe to have a slow recovery. The Biden package has $350 billion of support to fill the hole in the finances for state and localities, in contrast.
We're talking to Menzie Chin, professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison, looking at how the next economic relief package is shaping up in Congress. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What, if anything, would you want to see in another economic relief bill? Would another round of checks or unemployment benefits help you directly? Do you worry about the amount of federal spending? What questions do you have about what the economy needs most as the pandemic still keeps rolling on? Call 800-642-1234. We'll take your calls coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Menzie Chin, professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison, looking at the prospects for another COVID-19 relief package from Congress and what the nation needs now, what the economy needs now. Let's go to your calls at 800-642-1234. Rocky is with us in Plainfield. Rocky, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Rocky?
Well, I'm not making judgment on anything other than $15 minimum wage. If he throws that in there, all the small businesses are going to go up belly up. McDonald's are going to go to robots and all that stuff. There ain't going to be much for jobs, so $15 an hour don't make much difference, does it?
Rocky, thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, the Biden plan calls for boosting the minimum wage, Menzie, ultimately up to $15. What do you think of that as part of an economic relief package?
Well, I think that on other grounds, it would have been made a lot of sense to have raised the minimum wage before. You know, there's been a tremendous amount of erosion of the minimum wage at the federal level. The federal minimum wage is the sort of the floor that applies to all sorts of states. And, you know, last time it was raised was sometime, I believe, over a decade ago. So it's $7.25. Think about how much prices have risen over the past, you know, decade or so. And you can think, well, there's been a lot of erosion in the purchasing power of the minimum wage. Now, a lot of states have raised the minimum wage on their own. And so if we look at the impact of raising the minimum wage at the national level, it's not as if everybody is going to see their minimum wage rise. It's going to be applying to certain states, and maybe there'll be impact. But one of the things that we've learned over the past 20 years is that generally the impact of raising the minimum wage is not particularly big in terms of either the number of jobs that are lost and or passing on of prices. So on the other hand, we know that there's been a big distributional impact from this recession, where people who are at the lower end of the income spectrum in terms of income distribution, they have suffered disproportionately. Whereas people, white collar workers, for instance, people can telecommute, they haven't really suffered on average anywhere near as much as those people who are, you know, earning at the minimum wage. So if you balance off the benefits versus the costs and where you're trying to redress some of the inequities which have grown stronger or more pronounced over this recession, then a minimum wage increase probably makes sense. Even if there's going to be a little bit of disemployment in certain sectors, possibly, and possibly in certain states where $15 is high relative to the average wage.
Thanks for the call, Rocky. We'll go to Cindy in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello. Well, I think they should go big or go home. I mean, they're basically fighting over what I consider to be a pittance. And I think people should be getting stimulus packet or stimulus checks every month. They need to do something to help the states. They don't have any problem bailing out big businesses, but when it comes to the rest of us, they fight over it like, you know, peanuts. And it's, to me, it's ridiculous. We need to help people so we can get this economy going again.
Cindy, thanks for the call. Cindy saying the amounts that go to people fairly small in the given the scope of the problem, Menzie.
Well, I empathize with this view, but there is in the Biden package at least $1,400 additional per person, and then there's benefits direct payments. These are not unemployment insurance benefits, just direct payments for children per children. In both packages, both the Biden and the Senate Republican, you know, it's $465 billion in the Biden package, which is not inconsequential given the fact that we've already given several thousand in direct payments to each person. There's several trillion dollars of spending that's already taken place, and these are incredibly large amounts of spending relative to any sort of fiscal packages that we've undertaken in the United States since World War II. I mean, if you can just compare in what we used to call the Great Recession of 2007 to 2009, the recovery or stimulus package that was thought of as being so big was only about $878 billion. So we're many times larger than that. Granted, the challenges are much bigger, but in large sense, we are in the ballpark of trying to get enough support into the economy. And I also want to say, you know, it's not a typical stimulus package where you're just trying to kick up aggregate demand and spending to keep the economy going. You're also trying to support individuals and companies directly so that they don't fall out of the labor force, become homeless, and or firms go bankrupt. So it's actually an effort to keep the economy's productive assets in place. Given that, I think $1.9 trillion is not a crazy number. Seems reasonable given the challenges that are likely to come. On the other hand, well, $600 billion doesn't even fill the gap that we have in output, that is, you know, where the economy is relative to where we think it would be if it were operating at its normal level.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Menzie Chin from UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs, looking at what's needed from the federal government when it comes to recovery spending. A couple different plans in the works there. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Sharon is with us in Ashland. Sharon, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Sharon?
Well, I just wanted to say that I think more support for workers is needed, and I am particularly focusing on my situation in that I never received any unemployment support because I got bogged down in this incompetent management of this at workforce development in Wisconsin. And so I was never able to get my unemployment, and not because I didn't deserve it or wasn't entitled to it, but because the structures that had been set up to manage it just weren't working. And so, like I said, I have been without that kind of support. And so I would welcome more support from the federal government to make up for that.
Sharon, thanks for the call. Sorry to hear about that, Menzie. And Menzie, there are concerns in Wisconsin and some other states about friction in the delivery of some of these benefits, mm-hmm. even extra ones passed by the federal government.
Yes, I'm so sorry to hear about the troubles you face there. And, you know, in some ways, many of us economists have been warning about this problem for many years. What's been true is the unemployment insurance system that we set up in the country was, you know, based upon programs set up, you know, decades and decades and decades ago with antiquated software and equipment, you know, running even now. And we should have been able to update and modernize those unemployment insurance benefit systems beforehand, you know, during the good years, you know, the past few years before the onset of the recession. But we didn't. For a variety of reasons, states have underinvested in modernizing their computer systems and the unemployment insurance system. And in fact, some states, it was the intent of those in charge to make sure that the system was hard to access so that they could limit the amount of benefits. So Florida, it comes to mind, is one of those examples. Well, so we are reaping what we sowed. In that sense, that we didn't invest. And my hope is that this is a wake-up call so that we can modernize those systems even now or going in anticipation of the next downturn. Well, this also leads to the fact that, you know, we can't rely upon unemployment insurance as the only benefit, the support for workers. So the minimum wage is one way of increasing wages and incomes for particularly low-income workers. And then these direct payments, of which the Biden administration is proposing somewhat larger, I think it's $465 billion versus $220 billion for under the Senate Republicans plan, would be going to workers in general. I mean, everybody below a certain income threshold. So that is direct support, which, once again, rarely ever, if ever, occurred in a previous recession. So I sympathize with the view that we should be helping workers, particularly those who have struggled the most during this recession, more. I think in that sense, the Biden plan, which is on the table, it makes more sense.
Thanks for that call. Nate joins us next, calling from Madison. Nate, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to ask about, Nate?
Yes, so there's been a few trillion dollars spent in stimulus, and I think that this accounts for about a quarter of the entire M2 money supply now in the past year. When or are we going to see any effects of inflation in the coming years?
Nate, thanks for the call. That's the traditional thought, Menzie. Government spends a lot of money that drives inflation. Is that a concern?
Well, so let me, that's an excellent question. Let me sort of draw the linkages a little bit more closely. So historically, there have been cases where the government increases spending and then the budget deficit widens. Okay, so the budget deficit is the gap between the taxes that it receives and spending both goods and services and transfers. And, you know, the government has to pay for that somehow. It issues bonds. And, the question is, who's going to be willing to buy the bonds? Is it the public? Is it foreigners? And if they're not willing to, then the central bank, i.e. the Federal Reserve, has to. And the Federal Reserve pays with what's called high-powered money, which can result in more money in the system, M2, which is what the caller referred to, which is currency and checking accounts and savings accounts. Well, then you would have, in that example, maybe too much money chasing too few goods, and that's inflation. Well, we had a tremendous amount of Federal Reserve purchases of government debt in the last recession. And what happened? What happened was that inflation kept on falling, and we never could get inflation up to even on average the 2% target that the Federal Reserve was shooting for. And so there were many, many worries of many, many people about inflation in the previous episode, which just clearly did not come to pass. And one of the lessons might be that the sensitivity of inflation to overheating the economy, for instance, is a lot less than it used to be. So it's hard to contemplate at this juncture lots of inflation. Now, just because things have happened in a certain way in the past doesn't mean it won't happen in the future. And this is a bigger increase in government debt, which might require a bigger increase in the amount of government debt purchased by the Federal Reserve than in the past. So then you have to wonder, well, will all that money chasing too few goods then result in inflation? And I think the jury's still out on that. But you do have to remember, I don't think that the Federal Reserve is aiming to keep the amount of money supply at as high levels as it is right now. They're trying to keep the money supply way high because we're undergoing a serious downturn at the moment.
We'll leave it there. Menzi, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks.
That's
for
Menzi Chen from UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs, looking at economic recovery spending. Coming up, we'll learn about the iconic Badger statue in the Capitol and why its days in Wisconsin may be numbered. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, new research shows the world's insect population is on the decline. We'll find out why and how it could affect us down the road. Now, if you've toured the state capitol over the last 30 years, you've probably seen the Badger and Shield statue outside the governor's office. Maybe you've even rubbed its nose for good luck. So many people have touched the statue that the finish is worn off. Did you know the Badger's actually on loan from the U.S. Navy? It was the figurehead for a USS Wisconsin back before World War I. Well, the Navy kind of wants it back so it can be displayed at a nonprofit museum in Virginia where the second USS Wisconsin battleship is docked. After some discussions involving Wisconsin Congressman Mike Gallagher, the Navy agreed to extend that loan for another couple years. Fred Risser is a retired Democratic state senator from Madison. He served in the Capitol from 1957 through 2020. He was the longest-serving state legislator in the country. We'll turn 94 this spring. Senator Risser, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, this fella spent about half the time in the state capitol that you did. Are you glad to see it's going to stay outside the governor's office for another couple of years at least?
Well, I get used to it. They talk about providing it with a replica, but no replica will ever replace the shiny nose of the current Badger. Thousands and thousands of people go by, and they just rub their hand on that shiny nose, and that shiny nose cannot be replaced. I'm really happy that we're able to keep the Badger for another couple of years. It's a real real tribute, and it's a wonderful little to have in the state.
Now, Congressman Mike Gallagher, former Marine, worked with the director of the Naval Museum to try to extend the loan. Congressman Gallagher said in a statement, the USS Wisconsin figurehead reminds all who visit our state capital not only of Wisconsin's role in defending our nation, but also the courage and sacrifice of all the sailors who served aboard these legendary ships. What does it mean to you to have that symbol right there at our state capital?
Well, people talk about having a replica if necessary. But as I say, a replica is never as good as the original. And some people enjoy having to have an opportunity to touch the original, to see the original. And as I say, if you get close by, there's a very shiny nose. It means an awful lot to those of us who have been around, and you'll never have a chance to replace that. I'm pleased that the congressman was able to help have it for another couple of years, and maybe after a couple of years, maybe we'll have it a little more. It's a great piece to have in the governor's office, and I'm pleased at the results.
You know, we can't get into the Capitol right now, COVID-19. We can't really tour it right now. But when we can go back, are you glad to just have these kind of long-term traditions that that people can point to and see on a tour? Yeah. Maybe, you know, one generation can show it to the next generation in the future?
I think history is important. And I think having historical exhibits is also very important. The Badger, of course, has a lot of a great reputation in Wisconsin. We have athletic teams named after it as a school mascot here in Madison. We have Bucking Badger. It's in the state flag. Of course, it has been with the state ever since we were a territory. And it's part of history. And if you like history, I think you like having the originals of it ever possible.
And Senator Risser, before we let you go, you've been a former senator for just a month or so now. How is retirement treating you?
Well, you know, it's been just exactly 1 month since I started citizen life, I guess you'd say. And I haven't gotten used to it yet. You know, I live right across the street from the Capitol, so I can watch the Capitol from the outside, even though I'm not on the inside.
Any advice for your colleagues who are still in the business?
Well, they've got their work set out for them, and I would recommend that they go to work and take care of the problems which the state has. You know, we haven't met for almost a full year because of the virus, and I think it's time that maybe the legislature stand up and pass a couple measures to help get rid of this pandemic. I think the legislature will get to work. I'm watching it from around, and of course, I'll miss not being in there myself.
Senator Risser, good to talk to you again.
You bet. Bye.
Fred Risser is a former Democratic state senator from Madison, a long-serving state senator. We talked to him about the iconic Badger statue outside the governor's state Capitol office on loan from the U.S. Navy, and the Navy announced this week that it'll extend the loan for another 2 years after initially wanting to up that timeline. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. This month marks the program's 10th anniversary on WPR. As part of the celebration, here's Wisconsin Life's co-founder Todd Witter reflecting on two of his favorite stories that feature quintessential Wisconsin culture, deer hunting, and fish fry.
Finding ways to be with our neighbors in their space, you know, where they work, where they live, doing what they love, or what they do just to get by, those were things that guided me when producing stories for Wisconsin Life when we started it 10 years ago. Wisconsin is just so colorful with creative, committed, hardworking people, and my goal was to share each unique voice with our listeners. It was a chance to simply know someone. Sometimes I was able to create what I think of as a moment. It's like a snapshot or a postcard. They were only about a minute long. They were really tough to produce, but also really rewarding. Being able to drop in and experience a moment and come away with something that felt incredibly real, that was really special. And I have two of them today. The first one is with well-known Wisconsin author Michael Perry. I spent the day with him on his farm. He talked about raising chickens and writing, and well, we took this brief aside in his barn. I never actually planned to use this for a story, but later realized it had to happen. He started to show me this device that he had built, and I'm going to let him tell you.
Over here, you can see this homemade deer skinning device. This is one of the few things that I made and designed that worked out pretty good, but it's made out of a ratchet from a boat trailer. You know, you see people hauling their boats in from the water. I used that ratchet, and I bought some cable and a couple of pulleys. And then that's called a snatch block arrangement, where it goes up to the rafters and back over the two pulleys. And then what you do is you get your deer out here, and you hook the deer to the pulley. And then you raise the pulley, and when it gets to a certain height, you start skinning the deer with your knife. And then once you get the skinning started, you take this vise grip, and you just clip it onto the hide. And you hook the chain to the frame, which is immovable, and then you hook the chain through the wrench that's attached to the deer hide. Turn this ratchet, and it lifts the deer up, and it just pulls the hide right off. So that's redneck engineering at its finest, if I do say so myself.
It is such a vivid piece of audio. I don't think I've ever used the word visceral in my everyday speech, but for some reason, the word visceral seems the right word to use right about now. Another moment that I absolutely love. I was producing a story about one of the most quintessential Wisconsin experiences, the Friday night fish fry. And while you can find a fish fry just about anywhere in the state, Merrick's in Green Bay is a favorite of many, and for good reason. The Merrick family has been fishing in Green Bay since the 1890s. Much of their catch is what they serve for their fish fry. It's just incredible. Anyway, I was there with a food writer. We're talking about Wisconsin's fish fry culture and why Merrick's is so special, but then I took a moment to slip into the fairly small kitchen there and met the industrious Tony Melton.
Okay, well, I just grab a basket full of perch just like this.
Tony Melton, fish fry chef at Merrick's in Green Bay.
I try to keep the boneless perch up with him because that's what we use the most, is the boneless. And that's your headless perch. And then down here at the bottom, we have the rest of our stuff, and we take it like this, boom, boom, shake it, throw it in, and that's it. If you'd given six on the doubles and then the triples get nine, so
5 times 3, 1,500.
So it's anywhere from 3 to 5,000 we serve. That's quite a bit of fish. That's quite a bit of fish.
When I listen back to Tony and I hear that fryer behind her sizzling and bubbling, I can see it and I can smell it. And it's just one of those moments that I can't forget. It's what I mentioned earlier, being able to be in someone's space for just a moment, to get to know someone a bit more than we typically allow ourselves. And I'm so grateful to the people that I met doing Wisconsin Life Stories, the people who were so inviting and honest and openly shared a bit of their world with me and with all of us. It was an honor. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Todd Witter.
Coming up, we'll find out why the global insect population is on the decline and what we can do about it. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, three missions to Mars have spent the last 7 months hurtling through space. This month, they arrive, opening a new era of space exploration. Jen White has that story for you today at 6 on 1A+. Now, our next guest says the insect world is undergoing death by a thousand cuts. New research shows a number of issues, including climate change, insecticides, light pollution, and others, are killing off 1% to 2% of insects each year. Among the most well-known species experiencing declines in population are honeybees and monarch butterflies. And a lot of these species play an important role in ecosystems, the food supply, and waste management. So what can we do about it? David Wagner is an entomologist and professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Connecticut. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
How significant is this 1% to 2% annual decline in the insect world?
Well, I think it's not catastrophic, but alarming. It's hard to convey to the average person what 1% to 2% per year means. It doesn't sound like very much, but imagine that you had a $2 million home on a kind of wild river in Wisconsin, and each year you lost 1% to 2% of your land to erosion. After a decade, you might have 15, 20% of your land gone. And after 4 years or so, or 4 decades, you might be, you know, your house might be in the river. And so you really could lose everything over a period of say 3 decades or 4 decades.
What are some of the causes? And it sounds like there's a lot of different things going on here.
I know, we call it death by a thousand cuts, and that's the bad news. If you look at the monarch or the honeybee, and we know an awful lot about those insects, they're iconic. It's multiple stressors. It's climate change, but especially droughts. Sometimes it's pathogens from other countries that's certainly affecting the honeybee. And so in many cases, it has to do with habitat loss and the industrialization of agriculture. Climate change is huge and going to be playing an ever ever-increasing role, but it's in, you know, exotic species and urbanization and pesticides and so many other things.
Before we get to possible solutions here, I want to look at consequences. First of all, people talk about ecological services being done for humans by a bunch of different wildlife species. What kind of things do we lose when we lose insects?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is pollination. A lot of our fruits and nuts and vegetable crops have to be pollinated. You know, apples are the obvious one, but it's true of almonds and so many other crops. Maybe 80% of the plants on the planet are pollinated by insects. We want them. If you want, you know, Wisconsin's beautiful spring wildflower displays, you have to have insects or those will all go away. If you want to have bird songs in the spring, you have to have insects to feed those birds, but especially for those mothers and fathers to feed their nestlings. That's those nestlings eat practically their weight per day in insects. So, but we're also talking about soil formation, cleaning of our waters, and even in air. And so all of these things that we need in terms of nutrient cycling and pollination and removal of dung and carrion, it's all carried out by insects. They're really sort of the fabric of our forests and our streams and various ecosystems in Wisconsin.
And I don't want to be human-centric. You mentioned birds. What other ecosystem impact does a decline in insects potentially have?
Well, I mean, just the major thing is just how nutrients are cycled. They are what tether together freshwater streams and lakes and all of our land-based or terrestrial ecosystems. It's the tapestry of life. They are the webbing in food webs, and you just can't remove that at 1 or 2% per year without having these cascading consequences that affect the plants looking downward or affect all these birds and the wildlife looking upward.
Talking to David Wagner, entomologist and professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Connecticut, looking at long-term declines in insect populations around the world and what we can do about it. And David, on the show here, I've talked to people in the state about a monarch butterfly project where people and property owners and highway departments are encouraged to plant and leave in place things like milkweed to help migratory monarch butterflies. Is that an example of the kind of thing that we could be doing to turn around these numbers?
Absolutely. And the monarch is so iconic and so powerful for kids and children to watch that metamorphosis. It's a parable or an analogy of their own development. And I think when they watch that caterpillar turn into a beautiful butterfly, it conveys something hopeful about their own development and growth. And it's exciting. And you get to see it over 2 weeks of time. It's something that really rivets our attentions and our heart. And I would think that preserving monarchs or protecting them would be high on our list anywhere in the Midwest, particularly with all the oceans of soy and corn that are out there. They're, you know, eliminating their habitat. But I think even more importantly might be just rewilding part of our yard. You know, make some little portion of your yard a little nature observatory for your children. But just wildlife in general, you know, leave a little more room for Mother Nature. And, you know, that just some part of it that's maybe not cut, and that would cut down on your pesticide usage and any chemicals you're putting on your lawns. So I really love that. The most important thing people can do, individuals can do, of course, is to vote and to promote environmental policies. I think that has the biggest footprint or long-term effect.
You mentioned pesticides. What kind of changes would you like to see that even if we're still using pesticides, maybe we're using them more judiciously in ways that don't indiscriminately wipe out insect populations?
Well, yeah, I think we could make agriculture more friendly. So I think there's going to be pressure and interest in making room some wild habitats within these seas of soybean and corn and other types of agriculture. But this is an alarming fact. More pesticides in the United States are put on lawns and in commercial areas than they are in agriculture, which is phenomenal. So I think one way we can all help is just rolling back the cosmetic uses of pesticides in any way that we can.
Some of those bigger picture issues like climate change and the international transport of diseases from, you know, one place to another, those are harder, it seems like, to stop at an individual level. What kind of things would you like to see national governments do and maybe international cooperation do to try to tackle those problems?
Well, I'm scared to death by climate change. I mean, I don't think Wisconsin is going to be affected nearly to the degree that many other nations around the world are going to be affected. I'm seeing the West drying out. It breaks my heart. And so the declines are much faster there. But I think the most alarming thing for us to realize in the Northern Hemisphere is that the tropics appear to be drying out. And that's absolutely the cradle of Mother Nature and diversity and just absolutely fabulous numbers of birds and frogs and insects and butterflies and what have you. And there's these early indications coming out of Costa Rica are quite scary, that they're seeing much faster rates of decline than we're seeing here in temperate zones. And these tropical organisms have never seen droughts or experienced them. And these are going to be a commonplace. But climate change is also really important for people to think about because it has so many knock-on effects. You know, I think too many people think about climate change in terms of global warming, and they're thinking, they're hearing from scientists, 1 or 2 degrees centigrade. Well, what the heck does that mean? But I think you should actually, when you hear climate change, I think more serious are droughts. And so we're going to see very big changes in precipitation. We're going to see stronger storms. You've already heard about it. The first hurricanes and typhoons with winds over 200 miles an hour. These are the kinds of things that are really going to have impacts. You know, places in Wisconsin that always had good snow cover, they're not going to have good snow cover. And so all these animals that were hunkering under the snow or overwintering under the snow are going to be exposed to freezing conditions, really harsh conditions that they've never experienced in hundreds and hundreds of years. So it's these knock-on effects of droughts, of floods, of really strong storms, and all these fires, these horrific fires that we're hearing about in the Amazon and California and Australia. That's climate change related.
Do you have, as we wrap up, David, any hopeful signs out there you could share with us?
Well, sure. There's a lot more interest. You know, there's things like iNaturalist where there's a lot more people, lawyers and doctors and kids and parents working with their kids about using these nature, like iNaturalist applications, all the information they can find on the web. There's a tremendous surge nationally, interest in insects. You know, kids want to plant, you know, want to see these bugs. People are planting pollinator gardens. They're photographing these animals with their cell phones and uploading the images with artificial intelligence that can identify these things within seconds. And it's fun. It's a sport. We're collecting data every time they take a picture with their cell phone and upload it. There's a lot of funding coming from government. There's a lot of papers and information coming out about what people can do in their own yards. And so there's a lot now. We want to give people agency, you know, and they want to be part of the solution. And we really, you know, no matter what's coming down the Anthropocene and the pike, I think people want to help. And it's really important to give them agency. And we're seeing it.
David, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Okay. It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
David Wagner is an entomologist and professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Connecticut. We talked to him about some new research he led showing that climate change, insecticides, and other issues are killing off 1% to 2% of the global insect population each year. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 7, get the latest on the debate over Wisconsin's gray wolf population and calls for a wolf hunt in the state sooner than later. That's tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then it's our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics, including the latest on the lead up to next week's second impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate for former President Donald Trump. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.